I can't wait. I cannot wait for the conversation straight ahead with one of my literary heroes. His writing has moved me for decades. His voice is unique in the Christian world. His excellence, his depth, his way of capturing a thought and taking us deeper into our own experience and closer to the heart of God is unparalleled, in my humble opinion. Walter Wongren Jr. is our guest today at the Radio Backyard Fence, and we're going to talk about his life, particularly his early life. He tells a fascinating story in the memoir, Everlasting is the Past. It's our featured resource at chrisfabrylive.org. Nate McMillan's our producer today. Ryan McConaughey is doing all things technical. Frodo Washburn will be answering your calls, our assistant producer, at 877-548-3675. And a cameo appearance by Tricia McMillan and DL and Annie today. Great to have you guys here. And thanks for joining us. 11 o'clock at night, a young man drives through a snowstorm eastward on Interstate 64. He's midway between St. Louis and Oxford, Ohio. It is late November. The storm was unexpected. The young man is a first-year graduate student supported by a full scholarship at Miami University. The storm frightens him. His car is a yellow VW Bug with a rag top that ripples in his windy speed. The weather's cold enough to freeze his feet. Soft snow has sifted inside the pillows, his shoes at the floorboard. What frightens him most are the snowflakes, huge, globular. His headlights illuminate them in the distance where they fall like a curtain softly. Closer to the car, however, the thick flakes level and fly at his windshield, exploding like missiles. This fusillade is the personal assault of a malicious world. Until this particular day, the firmament, the earth, the sun, the moon, the clouds, and all creation had been a world in which he was a citizen. The Spirit of God blew through it. The love of God had made it. But now, as far as the young man is concerned, God is absent. The seventh seal of the scroll in the eighth chapter of the book of Revelation has been broken open, and now there is a vast silence in heaven, and the grounded wind howls. This strafing of the snow and his fear before it bears witness that the young man has lost his faith. Walt Wongren goes on in that opening chapter and at the end says, I am, of course, that young man. Walt Wongren has won the National Book Award, the New York Times Best Children's Book of the Year Award, several gold medallion awards. He was the speaker for the Lutheran Vespers radio program for many years. And prior to joining Valparaiso's faculty, served as an inner-city pastor in Evansville, Indiana. You'll read about that in the memoir, Everlasting is the Past. It is great to have you back with us. Walter Wongren, Jr., thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Chris Fabry.
First of all, your health. People who know you well and know your story know that you have been struggling with your health. Give us an update, if you would.
The tumors still exist in my lungs. I have lung cancer, but they have been very quiet for a good long while, longer than I had ever expected that to be the case. Therefore, I am here, a little breathless, but yes, very acute in my mind. It's a wonderful thing.
That's what I have heard. In some ways, you're slowing down, but in other ways, your mind is just as sharp, if not more sharp. Is that true?
All I need are two things: a smart mind and good fingers, and eyesight to watch the computer screen.
Yes. So you're still writing. There's nothing that's slowing you down from that.
Oh, no, no, no. In fact, I write more now than I did when I was fully engaged teaching or preaching. It's a pleasure. It's very good.
You spoke at Wheaton College, was it yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about faith in the face of death. What did you tell them?
Oh, my. It's a long story. I used a variety of examples to talk about what witness means. I wanted to disabuse us of the notion that witness, which in Greek is martyr, only applies to those people who suffered terrible deaths. Witness is how we live, and not how we die, but how we face death, our manner and our attitude of dying. So martyrs are not bound only into the first years of Christianity. They happen all the way through. I expect, and this is no pride on my part, in fact, this is a result of a genuine humility, I will be a martyr. I'm not afraid of dying at all. And I knew that from the first diagnosis, that it was 3B, lung cancer 3B. And I astonished myself that I wasn't afraid. I wouldn't have known that otherwise. Sometimes we really don't know the depth of our faith or the height of our trust in God until it is truly put to the test. Then we make the discovery. And when we were put to the test, my wife and I, doctors telling us to get our affairs in order, I was very happily surprised to find out that I wasn't troubled at all. Hmm. I called it the beginning of an adventure that I had never had before, and I was very interested in what was going to take place. That's martyrdom. It's our witness, and we don't have to bleed or grovel. We need merely give evidence of our hope. And Paul talks about that in 1 Thessalonians. He talks about the fact that we don't grieve as the world does. We don't grieve as those who have no hope. Vast difference between one grief and the other.
Yes. What did they say? What are the folks that you talked with? How did they respond to your message? Because it's always interesting what you have in your heart, what you express on the page or speaking, and then how they respond. What do they say?
Nobody went to sleep.
That's good. That's a start, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, there were good people there. And interestingly enough, one of the stories I told was about my sister-in-law, Lisa, who is a Filipino, married my brother. And I talked through the passage of when her father died in Manila. Well, she and my brother lived in the U.S., going back and forth. Afterward, a woman came up to me who said that she was a Filipina and that she lived here while her mother was dying in the Philippines. It's a remarkable parallel.
You know, it's very interesting as you're speaking. And I can hear a part of, you know, just the being able to speak is taking a breath, and it's difficult. I want to breathe for you,
okay.
You know? And I think everybody in the audience who wants to hear the words that you're saying, it's like, give him, oh God, give him another breath. Give him clear, you know, give him clarity here to say these things that you have learned in the face of death and then in the face of life. Because as I read earlier, you found yourself as a young seminarian, as a young person, feeling like you were losing your faith. Let me take a break. I'm going to come back. We're going to talk about that. It is written so well in the book, Everlasting is the Past. It's a memoir by Walter Wongren Jr. You can find out more at chrisfabrylive.org. You can go to the website, likes on Facebook while you're there, chrisfabrylive.org.
To reach the studio now, call 877-LIVE-675. That's 877-LIVE-675.
It is a great privilege to have Walter Wongren Jr. with us today. He is widely recognized as one of the most gifted writers on issues of faith and spirituality. He has written in fiction, essay, spirituality, children's stories, and biblical exposition. You can find out more about him at chrisfabrylive.org. The book we're talking about today is his memoir, Everlasting is the Past. You can find it at chrisfabrylive.org. Erwin Lutzer, I think it was a member of his family who was an aunt, walked into his room where the crib was and said, he will be the preacher, in German, I believe. And that's the title of his memoir, He Will Be the Preacher. Your father, you write, already from my birth was I shapen in the faith. On the first page of a baby book entitled Life Begins, my father inscribed his expectations for my vocation, the ministry, which was his own vocation, and he assured himself would also be mine. In block letters, black block letters, he printed the scriptures of his assurance. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as my father's son liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord.
And that's what he wrote about you. How did that shape you?
This is somewhat of an irony, I believe. Let me tell a little story and then move forward. When I was baptized and my father did the baptism, he had told the elders of the church that if I made a hullabaloo, then it only proved that I would become a preacher. So the baptism went forward, and I sweetly slept through it, after which the elders came to my father, and as he says, their faces were as long as hoe handles, very sad, and they said, "We're sorry, Pastor." And he said, "Why?" And they said, "He'll never make a preacher." The irony here is my father might lend me to the Lord, but that doesn't mean that I accepted that lending. Of course, I wouldn't have questioned it, and I didn't question it as I was being raised in his household. In fact, it felt like an obligation to me, not heavily at first, but it was an obligation placed on none other of his six children, of my six siblings. And so the consequence was, when I was 13 years old, it was assumed and it happened that I was sent away to a boarding school, pre-ministerial boarding school, Milwaukee, Concordia College it was called, where I spent 6 years in preparation for the Lutheran ministry. Now, the point is, in my father's house, where we prayed regularly, where we went to church, and it was without question, we celebrated all the church years, festivals, Christmas, Advent, Lent, Easter. I never questioned whether or not I had faith. It was assumed, even by me. And when I went to Concordia, likewise, I was surrounded by the elements of faith. It never occurred to me to question these things. I mean, chapel every day of the week, church on Sundays. All of our courses had to do something or other with the issue of ministry or the fine arts. It was when I graduated and did not go on to the seminary with my classmates, but took a detour and went, as you had read earlier, to Miami University in Ohio, in Oxford, Ohio, that I began to realize that the faith I had was rather a faith, or let me say, a churchiness that had me. In other words, when all these accoutrements of the church in my life, the biblical church, the Lutheran church and all that, when they were removed, then I began to realize that had been the faith I thought was mine. And in fact, at the removal of those things, I began also to realize that I was not carrying with me into the world that faith. At first, it didn't trouble me. I really believed, and in some sense it's true, that I was making a self-discovery and that I was beginning to see things as they were. Now, I want to be very careful. That was true. I was seeing things as they were. And at that point, you can do that even without the lens that Jesus gives us to see through to things as they were. My thought at that point was, there is a God. I never doubted that there was a God. But this God, so far as I could understand, was the infinite, the eternal, and all those phrases, omniscient, omnipotent, most holy, which in fact, holiness is that which separates us from the divine. Grace is how the divine comes to us, but holiness is an absolute separation. And that's what it would be. That's what it was. Now, I'm going to compact the story that you can find in this memoir very briefly and say the consequence was that I became very angry with God. Angry because God was limitless. And I always felt that if there were not this infinite, this limitlessness in the world, I wouldn't be so aware of my limitedness, my finitude. And so I began to think of God as lying in a holy bed, altogether asleep, and his arm flops out and it hits people and hurts them, but God is unaware. And how was I hurt? Let's see if I can explain this. I had limitless hopes for myself. Actually, in those days, I said I want to be the best poet of my generation. A limitless ambition. But day after day, as I set myself the goal of writing a poem every day after day, I'd write a poem. In the evening and in the morning, I would see that it was trash. And so this is my anger at God. God could dream, and it was. God could utter, and it was. But I could dream, and it would not necessarily be. And that's what made me angry. Let there be no infinite God, and at least my finitude wouldn't bother me. That's what I thought. Do we need to take a break now?
No, we don't.
Good.
But oh, let me, yeah. You were a thinker, though. Most people that are walking the planet at the same time you were doing this and seeing the snowflakes and feeling like God was in the bed, the holy bed, most people weren't thinking this. They're not the same kind of introspective people, and they weren't created that way. Mm-hmm. You were, though, and you walked with that. You went with that. Right?
Right. Is that a question?
It's not really, but it's an it's an open door.
Well, what I'd like to say next is what caused the change, and there are two parts to that. So you stop me, and we'll pick it up after a break if we must.
Okay.
The first thing is where I had thought I was strong in all of this and this recognition, actually strong in my anger, the way perhaps a crusader is strong against a powerful enemy, I began to feel weaker and weaker. The story you read at the beginning about the snow is that during that first year in graduate school, I began to feel lonely, and I assumed my loneliness was for my classmates with whom I'd been for 8 years. So I took a trip from Oxford in Ohio to St. Louis and to the seminary to visit my friends. As a matter of fact, they were all involved in their own lives, and there was no satisfaction. I left early with an increased sense of loneliness and returned. While I was there, back at Oxford, and at the beginning of the second term after Christmas, my loneliness, I can say this now, I didn't know it then, was elemental. It was the loneliness of a soul alone in the whole universe. And it became for me despair. So bad was the despair. I had been teaching a course that started at 8 o'clock in the morning. A course for freshmen and sophomores, what graduate students often do. And at first I had done it well. But as the month went on, January, I began to feel so lethargic and so unhappy and so isolated that I began waking up all right in time to get to class by 8 o'clock, but pretty soon just not having the stuffings to go. So I would lie in my one-room efficiency apartment and imagine my students coming into their room and looking around and waiting, and when the instructor didn't appear, leaving, confused, and yet I could do nothing about it. This was a loneliness beyond my comprehension. The next part of the story lasts a little longer.
We have time.
All right. Well, this loneliness became so bad that I drove in that little VW bug north to Fort Wayne, where there was a family that had befriended me when I was at school there. And I thought, this at last can be some help for me. I had four papers that I had to complete. We are now in March. And I had to prepare for my oral examinations, and I was absolutely stymied at these things. So I drove north to visit this family. I did that on a Saturday, expecting to drive south again on Monday. But the family was at odds. They were fighting. There was no place for me there except a greater isolation, being with friends who at that point were not friendly. And I remember then I drove home already on Sunday afternoon and into the evening. And I was at a desperate loss. I did not know what I could do. I did decide this, that I would go to the dean of the graduate school Monday morning and tell him of my situation and ask whether or not I could take in completes in those four classes. And continue, which I did. Early Monday, I went to see Dean Peterson, very kind man. And I told him, can I do this? His answer was, yes, I could, but I would lose my scholarship. And that, to me, was the slamming of the last door. I started to cry. He asked just gently what was the matter. And I blurted out, these words were not planned, I blurted out, I'm having trouble with God. This was nothing, of course, that Dean Peterson could answer. But his kindness was that he got up and closed his office door so I could cry myself out. When I had, and when I left Upham Hall, where he was and our classes were, I started walking through Little Oxford, took the main street. And I was, in fact, going nowhere. I was, this is what the author of The Cloud of Unknowing, we don't know who he was, wrote, I was a nothing in a nowhere, just walking. I walked out of the town. The road became a sort of a gravel county path, and I kept walking. No future, no to which I was going, just walking, foot in front of foot. I saw it ahead of me on the left side of the road, behind a splitboard fence, a flock of sheep. Behind them was a break of trees. And everything in me wanted to run at them, say, booga, 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 and scare them. Not quite sure why, except that I would have made some impression on something. But as I approached them, a farmer, I'm sure he was a farmer, you know, on coveralls, came out of that break of woods, and he made a sort of chittering sound in his mouth. And all the sheep that had been looking at me turned, flapping their tails, and followed him back into the woods. And I said, I want to be a sheep. And I meant, I need somebody to follow. I can't do it myself. So I returned to my efficiency one-room apartment. My father had long ago said, this is when I was 13 and leaving home, that John would be a good gospel to read. John, he said, shows the love of God. And so back in my room, I opened John and came upon the 9th chapter. Actually, it's a funny story. It made a big difference with me. Do I have time to go into it now?
I was just thinking, the last time you were here, we had to take a break right at this point.
Yeah.
And you said, oh, you've taken all the power out of it.
Well, you haven't taken the power out. This is a perfect time.
This is the perfect time. Yes, we're going to take a break.
Good.
And what? Are you going to say something else?
Not now.
No, Ben. Okay. All right, we'll come back in just a couple of minutes. And I know everybody who's listening to this, you got to figure out, so how does this end? How does seeing the sheep and wanting to scare them and then seeing this cry of the heart, I'm having trouble with God, and then the cry, I need to be a sheep. I need to follow someone. And the 9th chapter of John, how does that all work together? You're going to find out straight ahead. If you go to the website, our featured resource today is Walter Wongren Jr.'s Everlasting is the Past. You can find out more at chrisfabrylive.org. Walter Wongren Jr. is joining us today. You can find out more about him and his memoir, Everlasting is the Past, at chrisfabrylive.org. He wrote the renowned The Book of the Dun Cow. As a matter of fact, I just got an email. Let me read this. Your guest wrote two of my favorite books ever, The Book of God, and for me, the best was Paul, a novel, which came out just after I was saved. It was his reading of this audiobook, his characterization of Priscilla, Paul, James, Seneca, etc., that shaped my early view of faith in such a deep way. I must have listened to it more than 20 times. We even named the first of our two beagles, the first one who just passed away, Prisca, and when we got the second one, we could only name her Phoebe. So listening to this show is like hearing again from a dear old friend, or an old and dear friend, I should say. Walt Wongren is with us. So let's get back into the story then. What happened then when you went to John chapter 9?
All right. I believe it was sometime in the afternoon that I lay belly down on my cot and opened up the book. This is what I read. It was about the man who had been blind from birth. Jesus came to him. The man had no idea who this was. And laved his eyes with spit, told him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which the man did. He was obedient, had no idea who this was. That's important to be aware of. Washed his eyes and came back seeing. Now, he'd always been sitting in the same spot as a beggar. So many people knew him there, and when he came back, they weren't sure that this was the same fellow because he could see. No, he said, I am this fellow. A fellow came to me and told me to wash my eyes, and I can see. Well, the word got around. Very interesting that a man who had been blind from birth could see. And ultimately, it came to the leaders of the synagogue, who asked him to come in and, as it were, to be questioned, an inquisition. And so they asked him, how did this happen? And he told them, this man, and I could see. They said, well, this man can't be of God. He did it as a sin on the wrong day. Well, said this fellow, and the story goes on. The fellow doesn't change. The people who are questioning him get angrier and angrier. They bring his parents in, and his parents disavow everything. He's of age. Let him talk for himself, they say. So they back away, and you'll begin to notice that's what's happening, is this guy is becoming more and more isolated. The country is against him. Religion is against him. Parents are against him, and yet he becomes more cheerful. Moreover, he makes jokes. They ask him once again, who is this guy? He says, well, we know that anyone who can do this is a prophet. Is he a man of God? And the fellow says, well, y'all want to be his disciples too? That's a joke. He's completely unfazed. I thought that was wonderful. And then he goes off. Notice that he is alone, as I had been alone. You might say elementally, but he wasn't. didn't know who he was attached to or who he was following until Jesus came to him and said to him, "You know who did this?" And the man said, "No, but tell me and I'll worship him." And Jesus said, "I'm the one." And the fellow cheerfully worshiped the Lord who had done it all along, who had always been present, who had always been his shepherd. To me, this was freedom. I had up till this point identified myself by what I could do or not do. I was not a good poet. On the other hand, I had made very good grades in all my classes. Every class, an A. I had been doing it for myself. And then I ran up against this wall of not being able to write four papers, not even to begin to write those four papers. But at this point, what occurred to me was, so what? I started thinking of rivers. A river on a map goes a certain distance, and then it angles around something. You don't see it on the map, but you realize that it has come to a hill. It can't go over the hill, so it goes around it. Nobody blames the river for not going over the hill. They simply say, oh, that's the shape of the river. And I thought, okay, let me be a river. And I have come up to graduate school, and if I can't go over it, I'll go around it. Not get the degree at all, but no one will blame me. They'll just say, that's the shape of Walt's career. That set me free, which is to say, since I didn't have to write the papers, and since I didn't even have to write them well, I was free to write. Under no judgment at all, I was free. I wrote four very good papers. Moreover, when I came to my oral examinations, I was like that man who had been blind but now could see. I'll tell it to you this way. There was a man named Weidel whom I really didn't like. He was a foul-mouthed teacher, and so foul, in fact, that I dropped out of one of his classes, and I told the dean why, and there was no objection on the dean's part. But Weidel knew what I had done, and I was not his friend. Well, he turned out to be on my oral committee. He asked me a question about Samuel Taylor Coleridge, about Kubla Khan, a poem that Coleridge wrote. And I lightly said, oh, yeah, that was a fun part, wasn't it, that Weigel dropped his head and he quoted the poem. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. He was clearly not happy with me. And I didn't care. I was just fine. I was free. And I passed my oral examinations, and I continued the next year with my graduate work, still on my fellowship. That's the story. Then, following the Christ whose name I did not know, whose name I came to know, then the faith was mine and not the shell around me. It was the beginning. Now, everybody knows it didn't go swimmingly after that. I was up and I was down. I was cold and I was hot. But I'm pretty good now. I'm confronting my death and I do that quite happily. I am free.
And there were years then at this this inner city church in Indiana, in Evansville, that you spent that shaped you in some ways. But I want to go back to that. Most people would not, you know, they may have been in the same situation. They might be there now listening, been in that same situation where you're walking alone and you feel like nothing and you feel so untethered and bound up, shackled in a way, to what everybody else thinks or what everybody else puts over your life and wants you to do, et cetera, et cetera. And they will not remember the sheep. They will have had the same kind of experience but never remember it. But that's the mind that God gave you, that stuck with you, that farmer in coveralls, you know, that you can talk about him. And in the ninth chapter of the book of John, in the 35th verse,
oh, you looked it up.
I did. When Jesus heard that they had thrown the man out, he found him.
Mm-hmm.
He found him. And that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He was chasing after you, even though you didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. True.
Isn't that great?
Yes,
that great?
It is. It is. And if I'm able to talk about it, I'm sure there are all kinds of reasons we could go into. But I do think that even the poet who doesn't write good poetry can nevertheless be the poet for the people, which is to say, drawing into words and into imagery that which they may have experienced, but were completely unaware of the experience until somebody put a name to it. That's my job.
Yeah. Yes, it is, and you have done it so well all through the years. I have more questions. Walt Wongren Jr. is our guest. Our featured resource is his memoir, Everlasting is the Past, where he talks about these stories that he doesn't have the book in front of him. This is all coming from his mind, his experience, and he's just telling us about it. It's so refreshing to hear someone rehearse the way that God has moved in and made his home in Wally's life, because that's what they called you when you were a child, Wally. Walt Wongren Jr., you can find out more at chrisfabrylive.org, chrisfabrylive.org.
Have a comment about the program today? Call 877-LIVE-675. That's 877-LIVE-675.
Our remaining moments with Walter Wongren Jr., who has written so many great books. We talked about the Book of God and Paul, a novel, just a moment ago, the Book of the Dun Cow. His short story, Ragman, in the book Ragman and Other Cries of Faith, it's been one of my perennial favorites, and my guess is if I asked you to recite it, you could do it. I'm not going to do that today.
Thank you.
But you're welcome. A writer, a bricklayer, whatever the discipline, politician maybe, will look back on life and say, I wonder if that building that I built over there, if that thing is still standing. I wonder if those kids that I taught back there, what's happening? What about these 40-some books that you have written? What do you see as the crowning achievement of your career, quote-unquote, if you can call that? Do you look at any of these? They're all your children, right?
Right, exactly. Do you think that I would say that my son Matthew is a crown above my daughter Mary? There's your answer. You know, yes. I would like to say this now that I have the chance. You referred to the Book of the Dun Cow, which was published, in the early 1980s. This is 2000. And then I wrote the Book of Sorrows, shortly after that, as a sequel. After that, Madeline Langle, whom I knew, would almost annually write me and say, when are you going to write the Book of Joy? And I couldn't, though I didn't know why. And then she died, but her words were still in my ears and in my wife's ears. I began to realize, now this is just a few years ago, that I could not have written that book until I had come through almost all of my life. What I want people to know now is that I have completed a trilogy. I wouldn't call this a crowning achievement, but I would say that it is something that I hope enters the history of literature, these three books together. And so I'd like people to know that they exist. Amazon.com has all three of them. They can be gotten in paperback or whatever.
And what is this series called? What is the trilogy called?
This is how they go. The Book of the Dun Cow is the first. Second Book of the Dun Cow is called, it's that. That's its title. Second Book of the Dun Cow, Lamentations, which is a change of the title, you know. the third book of the Dun Cow, Peace at the Last. You see, I couldn't have written that till I understood peace at the last. And they go together, and they are the fullness, then, of this story of human progression. The Book of the Dun Cow deals with the evil which is outside of us. The next book, second book of the Dun Cow, as you would know, Chris, since you read it, deals with the evil inside of us. And the third deals with a social issue through which, with much suffering, we must go until we reach peace at the last. And so that concludes the series altogether. I'm glad to have a chance to say so.
I'm glad that you talked about Madeleine L'Engle, too. Did she ever give you any writing advice? Did you ever ask her for it?
No. No, we knew each other as writers from the very beginning. There are two things that she did, however. One thing she did and one thing we did for her. When our son Matthew in particular was young, we read to all of our children her her series, all the way the Swiftly Tilting Planet and so forth. And for Matthew particularly, it really persuaded him to know how to read and how to write well, even though he was a very young child. And we were able to tell Madeleine that first time we met her. The thing that we, or Than, did for her is we were together once, and she couldn't make her laptop work. And her way of trying to make it work was to slam it against the desk. It was Than who was able to come in then and make it work properly. That's the sort of exchanges we had.
That's what I used to do with the TV growing up. You're just banging on the side.
Yep, right.
The old Curtis Mathis. You wrote Letters from the Land of Cancer, which we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. And I really believe what you have talked about here, the reason why you are still with us, the reason why you have all of the energy that you do, is because you didn't look at your illness, quote unquote, as something to fight, but something to embrace in a sense and move through life asking, oh God, what do you want to teach me through this now?
Exactly. Right? Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I must say, the common way for people to talk about cancer is as if it were a war. He has been battling cancer all the... And then he died. Oh, so he lost the war. Battled cancer and lost the war. I don't like that image. I don't like it one bit. Cancer is not an enemy. I can't think of it that way. I think of it this way. Cancer is the result of my own cells going bad, doing wrong, sucking up things they shouldn't have. But they're mine, I hate to say. It's like my children. They're my children, even when they do evil things, even when they go off and are angry or steal or whatever. But I'm not battling them. I'm seeking to discipline them and to forgive them. I like that much better than the idea of battling cancer. In fact, when it became known that I had this, inoperable disease, among all the suggestions and advice people give one at that time, there was a woman. I came out of church one day, and she met me in the narthex, and she said, "It's the devil. Fight that devil out of you." Well, I didn't argue, but it wasn't the devil. That's to put in moral terms, spiritual terms, actually, something which was physical and for which the image of child for me is much better than crusader, lance, sword, and so forth. Are you there?
I have to read you this comment from a listener who says, "You have no idea how much your books have meant to our home. I wish we could sit down with you and thank you. We refer to you as our literary counselor." And you are that, Walt. I pray we get to have many more of these conversations.
Me too.
But this has been a good one, because you've been able to just ease us into your life and into this crucible when you were younger about faith, and is it your own or is it somebody else's, and then making it your own, and the hound of heaven, the sheep who is running after you mm-hmm. in that image. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time and making the effort to be in the studio today, and it's been great to get to talk with you.
You are welcome, my friend.
God bless you. God bless. Give Than a big hug for me, will you?
I will.
Walter Wongren Jr., Everlasting is the Past, is his memoir. You can find out more about it at chrisfabrylive.org, and we'll give information, too, about that trilogy that he talked about. It started off with the Book of the Dun Cow and then ended up with the piece, Peace at Last. Thanks a lot for listening to our broadcast. Remember, if there's somebody in your life that you think, oh, I want them to hear these words of Walt, you can send them to the website, chrisfabrylive.org. They can hear the program again on stream. They can download the podcast. You can download that on an app and say, take it with you and just listen to it whenever you want to. So tell your friends and neighbors. And thanks a lot for being here today. Sorry we didn't get to your calls, but I thought it was really important that Walt could tell his story unhindered in a way. And that was really good. Again, the title of the featured resource is Everlasting is the Past, chrisfabrylive.org. Our program's a production of Moody Radio, which is a ministry of Moody Global Ministries. Thanks a lot for listening.